You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on this first Friday in January 2017. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. Warm.
And we will be rebroadcasting this Monday morning at 8 a.m., yes. so keep that in mind if you don't get to hear all of it.
Or tell your friends about it, because it is going to be very interesting.
All right, we've got a bit of a problem with your mic, Mom. I'm going to switch.
Oh, and there. I can, yeah, okay.
Now, is this better?
That is definitely works for you and doesn't work for me.
Well, what, I wonder what happened.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm kind of spooky these days. Spooky things are happening to me. So,
all right. We may have to share the mic.
Oh, okay. Well, we can do that.
Okay. All right. Why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay. With my pleasure. Lisa Knopp is the author of 5 collections of essays, each of which explores the concepts of place, home, nature, and spirituality. What the River Carries, Encounters with the Mississippi, Missouri, and Platte was the winner of 2013 Nebraska Book Award in the nonfiction essay category and tied for second place in the 2013 ALSE, Association for the Study of Literature, and the Environment Book Awards for Environmental Creative Nonfiction. She's a professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, where she teaches courses in creative nonfiction. She grew up in Burlington, Iowa.
Just down the road.
Just down the road, and now lives in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lisa. And the book we're talking about today is Bread, A Memoir of Hunger.
Very interesting.
Thank you. Be here.
So you're calling in from Omaha, or?
I'm in Lincoln. I work in Omaha, but live in Lincoln, and get back to Burlington as often as I can.
How far apart are Lincoln and Omaha?
Well, my commute is an hour from my door to the parking garage. You know, the country miles between 46 miles.
Mm, right. So tell us a little bit about Bread, A Memoir of Hunger. What caused you, what inspired you to write this book?
Good question. And I have a couple answers to that. The
okay.
First one is that 3 or 4 years ago, I was working on a collection of essays that I haven't finished yet because I wrote Bread instead, and I wanted one of the essays in that collection to be about how much I love bread, and I love eating bread, I love baking bread, I love the symbolism of it, and I was working on this essay, and it kind of came up in the course of the essay that when I was in high school, I probably had anorexia nervosa. It wasn't diagnosed because people really didn't know what it was at that time. And so I wrote a little bit about that and a lot about bread, and the essay kept growing from 20 pages to 30 pages to 40 pages, and I thought, this is not an essay.
Yeah.
I gave it to 2 different people to read, my daughter, who's always my first reader, and then there's an editor that I work with, and they both read it and said, this is really fascinating. You need to unpack this. You've got a book here. And so that's one answer to where this came from. I thought I was writing about one thing, and actually I ended up writing about something else. And that happens a lot in my writing life, and I actually find that pretty exciting, and it gives me a lot of trust and faith in myself. The other answer, I was walking on the Mopec bike and pedestrian trail here in Lincoln, very beautiful former rail bed, and God told me it was time for me to go into ministry. And I rather gasped at that, and I answered, I am not going to seminary. I've all of my life gone to school since I was 5 years old. I'm not going to seminary. And the answer was, that's not the kind of ministry I have in mind for you. you've got a story to tell. And I believe the bread is the answer to that call.
Mm.
And the reason I say that, the book elicits two very different reactions from readers. There are some people who maybe send me a Facebook message or something and say, I just got bread from Amazon, I'm reading it this weekend, and I don't hear back from them. And I think that's because eating disorders and disordered eating, some people don't believe that's a real problem. They see it as maybe a character flaw or some moral failing or some cry for attention, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group of readers, and these are people who say, I just got your book from Amazon, I'm going to read it this weekend, and I hear back from them the next week. And their response, some of those move me to tears. There are people who have just connected so deeply with my story. Many people have not heard about disordered eating. Everyone knows about eating disorders, but to even get that term, some people have said, now I have a name for what's wrong with me. And now that I have a name for it, I have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then people just connecting with different parts of the story. And so the response from that group, I think that this is the ministry I was called to tell people that we are really hungry for things, and it may not just be food. We may be hungry for many other things, and we've got to address that. And that is the deep story in bread.
Well, I was wondering if you had kept a journal, because the details are so, it's full of details, and of everyday details, and how you could possibly remember that if you hadn't kept a journal. So, but if you were writing essays, I can see how that could be then.
Well, I'm not much of a journaler. That was something I used when I was young in my writing, and I'm pretty settled in my writing, and I find that isn't very valuable to me personally anymore. With a lot of these essays, I just wrote them over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the act of doing that triggers memories.
Oh,
I also
sure.
Know how to do research to trigger memories. One of the things I do is I told Karen Carpenter's story, because that was the anorexia story that awakened America to eating disorders, 1983. And as I was writing that, I listened to Carpenter music. And just listening to some of those songs that were popular when I was in junior high and high school brought back all kinds of memories, both about her and about myself at that time. So I used triggers to help me to remember things. My mom died last January, but she was alive when I was working on the book, and I could ask her questions about time periods and what she remembered. So mm-hmm. I did various things to get details.
Now, Lisa, you mentioned that the book is about eating disorders and disordered eating.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us the difference, the distinction between those two?
Yes, I was hoping you would ask, actually. I would like for the listeners to imagine a continuum of attitudes about food and eating and size and weight and self. And on one end of the continuum are those people who have normal, healthy relationships with food and their bodies and their appetites. And by normal, this is my definition, that means eating when you're hungry and not eating when you're not hungry. When you're preparing food, you know, the various tasks that go in, shopping, cooking, cleaning up after eating, it's appropriate to think about food then. But when you're doing other stuff, you really shouldn't be thinking about food all the time. That's my idea of normal eating. On the other end of the continuum are eating disorders, anorexia nervosa, and bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder. And those are clinically defined and diagnosed eating disorders. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the fifth edition put out by the American Psychiatric Association, they set forth the characteristics of each of those and what you must meet, essentially, to get the diagnosis. So those are the two extremes, healthy eating and eating disorders. And between those two poles, there's a pretty big territory. And that is what I label disordered eating. So people who aren't eating in a healthy way and people who don't have one of those clinically defined and diagnosed eating disorders. And it may be somebody is pretty normal, but there are times in their lives when maybe they go on a crash diet or they eat a little too much. There may be some people who are closer to having a full-blown eating disorder, and maybe they're binging and purging a lot or really restricting a lot and getting pretty thin and unhealthy and all the psychological stuff that goes on with that. And we move around in that gray area between the two poles. You know, maybe if life is more stressful or if there's some big loss, you might move closer to unhealthier eating and then life gets back on track and you move closer to more balanced eating. So I think that in this time and place, probably most women have disordered eating. I read one psychologist who said that disordered eating behaviors are now normative, and it's more typical than not to have a negative view of your body and your size.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
it's the people I talk to, the people who are reading my book. There are a lot of people with disordered eating, and they're the ones that they know they're not eating healthy, and they know they don't have a full-blown eating disorder, so they don't have a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if food is causing misery in your life, or the way you perceive your body or yourself, yeah, it is a problem, and you do need to work until you're in a healthier place with that.
So what are some of the, in this book, you kind of cover certain times of your life where your eating was more disordered than others, and how did that manifest for you?
I have had three episodes where I restricted my food intake to a point where I wasn't taking enough food to meet my body's needs and losing weight and feeling pretty awful about myself. I have never been diagnosed with an eating disorder, so I call these three episodes, I call it my malady. And it's something that I think I will always in some way have to be aware of and keep working on. It's not going to go away. When I was 15, in response to some rather frustrating circumstances in my family, I decided that the best way to handle that situation was to put myself on a diet of fewer than 600 calories a day.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is next to nothing. And I think I was probably maybe more like 400 calories some days. I was just eating fruits and vegetables that had very few calories. Like, I wasn't eating potatoes. I was eating more like lettuce and carrots. And I would eat some rice cakes and occasionally boil an egg. And I drank a lot of pop. And that was my diet. And I lost weight very fast. I became pretty anemic. I stopped menstruating. And my hair was falling out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't smell very good. But I felt empowered by this. And I felt that I was keeping myself safe by really controlling what I put in my body. I felt that I was gaining something. I felt triumphant. And my mother had gone away that summer, and when she came back at the end of the summer, she took me to the pediatrician. And I think he must have just thought this was some kind of crazy dieting I was doing. So remember this was 11 years before Karen Carpenter, and most people had never heard of eating disorders then, and probably doctors weren't looking for them. And his diagnosis was that I needed to go home and eat more.
Duh.
I don't remember a blood test or being given iron medications. I don't remember him seeing this as maybe a psychological problem. It was just, you need to eat more.
Wow.
And I did, eventually. And it's never good to go back and regret the past. And yet, I do wonder, since I've done all this research for Brad, what might have happened if I had gotten treatment mm-hmm. when I was in high school, what the rest of my life might have looked like. When I was... just right before I turned 25, I took a job in Omaha and a high school teaching position and moved away. And I had been living out in the country with my parents and brothers and grandparents on a gravel road. And, I had family and all kinds of familiar things around me. And I'd never lived in a big city. I'd never had such a hard job. I was someplace where I had no friends. I didn't know anyone, and I started restricting again. But it took a different form this time. I became very afraid that something was wrong with my food.
Mm. Yeah, that must have been a really difficult time.
It was. There was a lot of fear, and this developed in response. Before I moved away from Burlington, I had been tending bar. Part-time while I was hunting for teaching positions, and I had taken some iced tea to work with me, as I did every time I worked, and there was a man who poured alcohol in it, and I was working very hard, got very hot, threw down my tea, and, why am I feeling tipsy? Mm. And I confronted him, and I think the fact that somebody had done something to me without my permission, I think that is what set off this whole fear of that something was tainted or poisonous or something would damage my mind in what I ate or drank. So I only ate if I felt the situation was safe. I threw out a lot of food because I was fearful about it. And I lost a lot of weight. I had a roommate at that time that moved into... I contacted roommate finders and found a woman with a big house, and she wanted a roommate. And she asked me to move out after living with her for 3 months. And she said, and you need to go see somebody. You've got problems. And I had never known anyone who had gone to therapy where I came from. People just didn't do that. You either ignored your problems or talked to a friend about it, but you didn't go see a therapist. And so... this took a lot of courage, but I did go, and I spent 3 years in therapy working on the fears and some of the food issues, and learned a lot about myself. I can't say it really helped with the food issues, but what did cause that period of my life, that bout in my malady to end, was the birth of my son. Mm. And I don't know exactly why that is. I can speculate. I think the hunger of pregnancy and even more so of lactation. I was just hungry. You burn a lot of calories when you're, breastfeeding a baby. And also I think there was just so much more at stake. I needed to have it together for this child of mine. But the behaviors, it didn't like they just stopped, but they kind of fell away over the course of maybe a year. And then I had about a quarter of a century of pretty normal eating. I, ate as much as I wanted. I was carrying a little extra weight because instead of one piece of pie, I might have two. But I was normal. I didn't think about food all the time. If I went to a potluck, I ate whatever I wanted. And that continued until I was 54 years old. and I started restricting again. I was very surprised once I realized what I was doing, because I thought, you know, that was just stuff from when I was young and not very grounded. But here it came back when I was 54. And what set it off, I lost quite a few people in my life. My children moved out and moved on with their lives as they are supposed to, but I was an empty nester. I had been divorced many years, so I was living alone. My father died, my son's father died, and a couple friends moved away. So it felt like there was all of this human loss, important people in my life. And then I noticed that I was older.
It happens to all of us.
Didn't like what I saw. There's a lot of ageism in this culture.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's especially hard on women. We're taught that as we get older, we have less power. We become less visible. We're redundant. And I didn't like that. It wasn't aging so much that scared me as ageism, that I was being told a story that I did not want to live. So all of that was happening at once. And I felt a lot of grief and loss and fear. And so what I did in the past to make myself safe and give me power, I did it again. I started restricting. And it looked different this time. I was using a lot of health concerns to limit what I ate. I've been a vegetarian all my life, so that continued, but I was diagnosed with a gluten problem in the late 90s, which sometimes I took care of by following a pretty gluten-free diet, and sometimes I didn't. But I decided that I would just be pretty rigorous about that. And I was concerned about organic food and GMOs and all kinds of things. And I think that's how I justified to myself the restricting I was doing. That really, I'm just trying to make myself as healthy as possible here. So I can't eat this, and I can't eat this, and I can't eat this, and I can't eat this. And boy, there were many things left that I could eat. So I started losing weight, and as with the other two times, the regimen became pretty all-consuming, and that was not a healthy place to be either. I felt pretty straitjacketed by restrictions. And it was my daughter, my daughter who was 20 at that time, who she said, "Listen, you've got an eating disorder. If you don't eat more, you're going to die." And she's always and still is a pretty straight shooter with me. I think I do that for her, too. And that really shook me. It didn't waken me up. I still continued the restricting, but I couldn't get that off my mind. You know, my daughter thinks there's something wrong with me. I think I'm doing everything right here, but she's saying there's cause for concern. And then I started writing an essay about bread, and somehow those two earlier episodes of my malady came in, and then I started reading about eating disorders and hunger strikes and saints who fasted and all this stuff surrounding food, and I thought, yeah, it's back, and I've got to get through this somehow.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Knopp, the author of Bread, A Memoir of Hunger. Lisa, I know a lot of people who, you know, eat the way that you described your last episode.
Uh-huh.
You know, no GMOs and no gluten and maybe no dairy and no sugar. And,
right.
And they all think they're doing it to be healthy. Uh-huh. Now, I have actually had a friend who ended up in the hospital.
Yes.
Almost starving himself to death because he was eating so healthy. He was doing, I think, a juice fast for like a month or something like that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
But also, I have a lot of other people who do that to some extent, who eat like that and think they're eating really healthily. Is there a line, and how do you know when you've crossed the line between eating ultra healthy and actually disordered eating?
That's a very, very good question. There is an emerging eating disorder. It's not one that's listed in the DSM put out by the American Psychiatric Association, but it's one that's getting a lot of attention, and it's called orthorexia nervosa. And it's really an obsession with right eating.
Mm.
And it's people who go overboard, usually on food purity issues. And there is a line, because we know that there are things wrong with our food.
Yes.
Know that if you're going to eat meat raised this way might be better than that way for your health and for the well-being of the animal, too.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to pay more for eggs where the chickens are fed vegetarian feed, or the stuff where they may have antibiotics? There's some real concerns with the food supply. But I'm floundering here because I don't know where the line is. I have friends, I look at them and I say, you've gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
Because their life is too restrictive. There are too many things they can't do. I had three friends over for lunch about a year ago. And one friend came and hardly ate anything because of all these restrictions she had. And I thought, you know, this is a special occasion. You know, I have people over for lunch maybe once every 10 years. special occasion, and I worked very hard in the meal, and everybody brought something to contribute, but she wouldn't eat. And I know that she is just very restrictive. She's vegan. She does a lot of fasting. And I could see it in her, and probably people can see it in me when I go out and ask, you know, the food server 20 questions about what's in the stir fry that I'm ordering.
I know some people like that.
Yeah, that's me. You know, I want to know about the MSG. I want to know what kind of oil they use, everything. And I think there are times we just need to be flexible. And people with orthorexia are not. They're not. But that's a, like I said, it's an emerging eating disorder, and I think, boy, a lot of people have it, and we can understand where it comes from.
Definitely.
Definitely. And like anything, it can go too far.
You know, I've had some friends who've done...
It didn't really answer your question, but...
No, but I know what you mean. I have some friends who've done the raw foods thing.
Oh, yes.
You know, yeah, it might be really healthy, but they end up spending, in order to get the protein that you need from a raw foods vegetarian diet,
yeah,
you end up having to spend a tremendous amount of time and energy on your food.
It's all consuming.
It's all consuming.
How in the world do you do it?
I don't know. Oh, they do cashew, you know, nut butters and you know, things like that.
But
you know, making all that stuff or obtaining all that stuff, it's either very, very expensive or it's very, very time consuming.
Yeah.
Or both.
What does that do with your quality of life?
I know.
Sometimes... When I first moved to Omaha, decades ago, early 80s, I took a course in Tarot from an imam who I think was, you know, pretty far along in his personal evolution. And he was a vegetarian, and he and his wife grew all of their vegetables. But once a year, he went to the Nebraska State Fair and ate a hot dog. And he said, I don't want to become too rigid about anything.
Once a year, okay.
You know, I remember reading...
That's beautiful.
...an essay one time by someone who, and I can't remember who it is now, but who... had been a strict vegetarian, maybe even vegan, but he was in another culture, I think, an Eastern European culture, and it was for a celebration, and they had all kinds of meat on the table, and not just, you know, the normal meats that we eat here, but really peculiar things, you know, organs and things. And he ate it all. And because to have refused would have, first of all, been an insult.
Yeah.
And secondly, because it was, the food was part of this love and the celebration and this community. And he wanted to be a part of that. And he had no bad repercussions from it.
You know, I think when the most important question I want people to ask themselves after reading this book is, what are you truly hungry for?
Mm.
And I think we fill a lot of our hungers with food and things and all kinds of stuff that don't really feed us. And I think what many of us are really hungry for is community. And food can take us into that, and food can exclude us from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say your friend made the right choice. There are times we just, and I say this without being good at it myself. I'm very, very rigid and restrictive. And when I put aside my restrictions and try to enter into an eating situation that may be uncomfortable, I am uncomfortable. But there's more for me to be gained from being able to eat with people and share that with them and feel full because of the companionship than following my self-imposed regimen. I can go home and do that.
Right.
But sometimes we just need to be flexible and eat the hot dog. And then, you know, even though you're pretty vegetarian every other day of the year.
So, Lisa, did writing this book help you to lessen your restrictive eating?
Well, it's still there. I want to say that my weight is stable. I'm healthy. But I still have very restrictive thinking about food. And when life throws me something difficult, I'm just going to stop eating. I'm going to get control of this and feel safe. I think I'm going to have that there on some level the rest of my life. But after writing this book, I have so much more self-knowledge.
Mm.
And I had denied a connection between my life the past several decades and that woman of 25 who was hiding food in her closet because she was so afraid that it was poisoned, and that teenage girl who was eating just lettuce and plums some days. I have accepted that those other two, that girl and that woman, are part of me now, and that is very valuable. I don't think I'll ever get in a bad place again, though I may never be free of this.
Mm.
And you know, disordered eating, that was a new concept for me, and I thought, well, I've never been officially diagnosed with an eating disorder, so maybe I don't need to worry about it. Well, yeah. Disordered eating, especially for people who are, you know, almost anorexic or almost bulimic, it can be pretty bad. And I do need to take it seriously, and I do need to take care of myself and be watchful, and a few people in my life are helping me watch this.
Knowing all the symptoms that you do now, having studied this, must be extremely helpful in guiding you.
Yeah, self-knowledge. I don't think we can have enough of that. You know, it's the truth that makes us free. And to know what to look for, and that I've manifested some of those, and to be able to talk to other women and recognize their symptoms, or for to know that they're seeing a similarity between theirs and mine, that's been very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa, would you like to read a section from Bread?
I would love to.
Great.
And I will tell you what I'm going to read. I want to read something positive, so I'm going to read the last few pages of the book where I share with readers my daily healing ritual. And there's a one-paragraph setup, and then I will read those few pages, and I think this takes about 8 minutes, right around there. So here's the one paragraph set up, and then I'll pause, and then I'll read about the ritual. For most of my adult life, I've limited my choices to two: binging on bread, abstaining from bread. The third choice, eating bread in moderation, is one with which I have had little experience. It's a choice that terrifies me. If I bring bread into my home, I might eat, mindlessly eat, and once again, I'm bigger and disgusted, or back to restricting. The third choice is a walk along the narrow way that passes between the dichotomies of mind and body, spirit and flesh, reason and desire, public and private, culture and nature, bread as symbol and bread as physical reality. Christian theologian Marcus Borg refers to the narrow way as the path of centering in the sacred. Perhaps by creating a ritual that involves making and eating bread that is at once physical and spiritual food, I will be nourished, filled, and healed. On a Saturday morning, almost 42 years after the first episode of my malady, I close the blinds so I won't be distracted by the cardinals in the forsythia bushes. I light a candle on the dining room table, place a slice of homemade bread on a china dessert plate, pour a glass of water, and sit down. I'm taking this bread straight, no cream cheese, no peanut butter, no jelly, no hummus. When I eat meals alone, which now is most of the time, I often skim the newspaper, scroll through Facebook posts, or listen to NPR. What results is fast, distracted eating, raw consumption. What I'm doing here for the next 10 minutes is the opposite of that, eating with full and unflinching attention. I center myself by feeling my feet on the floor, my buttocks on the seat of the chair, and the small of my back firmly against the back of the chair. I soften my breathing, my gaze, and the muscles in my face. I feel my hunger in my stomach, my mouth, and my brain. I offer thanksgiving for this bread, ask for presence of mind, God's protection, and the ability to see this ritual through to the end one more time. This bread will satisfy some of my hungers, but others are beyond the power of any physical food. I must remain clear as to which hungers I'm humbly attending to and which are left wanting, so I never again hide, forget, deny, or disguise them. In my mind's eye, I see myself, a small, thin woman, blue-green eyes, blonde hair, though my face is framed by short, wiry gray hairs, a face that is longer than it used to be and etched with both laugh and frown lines, a body still supple from more than 30 years of yoga. I see the dense brown slice of bread that I will soon take into myself one slow, deliberate, savoring bite at a time. This is not an ordinary meal, but a homeopathic remedy, a strength-building regimen, a spiritual discipline, a sacred rite. I watch myself take a bite of bread too small to be a mouthful and put the slice back on the plate. After I chew and swallow, I pause. Before the next bite, I again center myself, feet, buttocks, small of the back, breath, gaze, hungers. How many calories will I be consuming at this simple meal? About 80. I'm remarkably accurate when estimating the number of calories in a serving of food, but now I'm anxious and my stomach is full of needles. How careless of me not to have counted the total number of calories in the entire loaf of bread, measured the length of the loaf and the thickness of the slice on my plate, and then divided the width of this slice into the whole so I'd know the exact number of calories it contains. 78? 82? There's a difference, you know. I start to run the numbers in my head. 1/3 of a cup of oil, 630 calories. 2 packets of dry yeast, 42 calories. Stop. I don't want to waste this slice of my fleeting life thinking about what cannot fill me, or allowing something to keep me from pursuing what can. Feet, buttocks, small of the back, breath, gaze, hungers, this slice of bread. My healing rite involves just one slice of bread and 10 minutes of my life spent in the here and now, halfway between breakfast and lunch each day. but I don't look forward to it. Many days I stall. Then I'm both the rule breaker and the rule enforcer. Just let me grade 3 more essays or answer 5 more email messages or run a little errand or make a phone call or sort the recycling, I tell myself. Or since I'm running late for my office hours, would it be okay if I ate the slice in 4 swift bites while standing at the sink? But I remain firm. What I hope is that my daily bread eating exercise will eventually release me from my rigid, restrictive thinking. What I'm certain of is that my daily right keeps me honest and dependent on God. I watch myself take another bite of bread and chew slowly, tasting the blend of flours, the vinegar, oil, and milk, the yeast that leavens it, and the gums that hold it all together. The texture is grittier and drier than bread made from wheat flour, and it's not as sweet as I like since I forgot to add honey. But it's not perfection I crave, but substantial, earthy bread. I let the bread dissolve on my tongue just as I do at Holy Communion so I can savor the sacrifice and the fulfillment. Bread and water, prison food. Bread and water, the food of liberation. I pick up the slice, take another bite, and put it back on the plate. It's a razor's edge I walk. How tempting it is to wolf down this slice and the rest of the loaf. How tempting it is to throw it into the sink as if it's on fire, douse it with water, and then cram it down the garbage disposal. Instead, I remain at my dining room table eating, poised between the past and the future, between stuff or starve, between what I'm told about myself and what I know to be true. Simply eating this slice of bread and attending to the sensations. This act of eating bread with the entirety of my being feels decadent and indulgent. How many of these simple mindful meals will it take to erase the vestiges of all those times when I denied my desire for bread or ate bread as filler? How many of these simple mindful meals will it take to provide the fullness I crave? When I've eaten the last crumb, blown out the candle, open the blind, and set my plate and glass in the sink, I feel relieved that the ritual is done for another day. And yet, the bread was good, and for a moment here and there, I found pleasure in eating it.
That was Lisa Knopp reading from Bread, A Memoir of Hunger. So, Lisa, one of the things I enjoyed about the book is that when you write about your childhood or your adolescence in Burlington, and it's very similar time to, you know, I was about that age and I was living in Fairfield, just down the road.
Probably very similar, yeah.
Yep, a lot of similarities there. And so you say you'd like to get back to Burlington as often as possible. What draws you back there?
River.
Ah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love those blossom yard. I love the land there. It's a beautiful little city. So that's a huge draw. I like going to the place where I grew up and just returning to the parks and the schools and just places where things happened. I have a few friends there. I have an aunt and uncle who are in their early 90s that I like to visit. And it's just good to be back there. I don't get back there as often as I like. It's about a 6.5 hour drive if I take 34, and a little shorter if I take the interstate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also hard not to have anybody to stay with there. I remember when there were lots of people I could stay with. You know, my parents were there, my grandparents, two sets of grandparents, and all kinds of people. So it's odd to be there, staying in a motel and eating lunch at the Hy-Vee Deli or whatever, but it's such an important part of who I am that I do need to get back and be part of it.
I was tickled to read when you talked about the University of Iowa and that you went there, because I went there, and also since I live in Mount Pleasant, Iowa Wesleyan. You mentioned that, so you know it. I don't know. It draws it together to me to know that you were there in those places too that I was. You know.
Yes, yes, and I love Fairfield. I will tell you that.
I was going to ask if you've been to Fairfield.
Yes, yes. Back in the early 80s, I was initiated into TM, and as were a lot of people back then.
Right.
And I just loved going to Fairfield. I loved some of the shops and just walking around. And it's for such a small place, it is so international.
Oh,
absolutely. When was the last time you were here?
Oh, well, you know, I don't take 34 the way I used to.
I know, and even if you did, it bypasses the town now.
Yeah.
I know, and so it's out of my way to go. It's been several years. Have there been a lot of changes?
There have, and I think it's even better than ever.
It is. All the time changes.
Yeah.
I mean, just continues to get better.
We have really a thriving artistic community, thriving literary community, a lot of things going on. We have, we're one of the premier stops on the indie musician tours of the United States. So we get a lot of independent musicians that are, maybe they have a gig in Chicago and they have one in Kansas City and we're midway. And so, we get a lot of musicians that you wouldn't expect to get in a town this size.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I need to go there. I'm
you
going
do.
To.
You do. And you should do a reading. We also have, of course, one of the best independent bookstores in the country, Revelations.
Okay.
Cafe and bookstore.
I would love to. I'm going to be giving a reading in Iowa City in late February, and I thought after I do that, I would just go down to Burlington for the weekend.
Well, you
and
should,
I'm always glad to have an excuse to get back to that part of the state. So,
well, you should call Revelations Bookstore and ask for Freddie and set up a reading.
Ask for who?
Freddie.
Freddie. Okay, yep. Revelations.
Yep.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and let me know, and
you can announce it. Yeah.
We'll announce it on the show, on Writer's Voices.
Oh, good,
if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Knopp, author of Bread, A Memoir of Hunger. And Lisa grew up in Burlington, Iowa, attended Iowa Wesleyan in Mount Pleasant and University of Iowa. Yeah, tell us a little bit about your academic career and how you became a professor yourself.
Well, my short answer is kind of by accident. but the long answer, I started at the University of Iowa as a music major, and, at that young age, I just did not have the discipline for all that solitary practice. And I dropped out of school for a while. I came home. I lived with my folks, tended bar, and then started going to Iowa Wesleyan College. And I was pursuing English education there to be an English teacher. Now, I didn't feel that was my heart's desire, but I didn't know what else to do. And I did fall in love with literature and writing, and I got my teaching certificate and interviewed for some jobs and took the one in Omaha. And very quickly figured out that I probably wasn't meant to be a high school teacher. So
what was your first clue?
I didn't want to deal with discipline and class organization, and those are huge. I also, my very first semester, I had 135 students.
Whoa.
I was just not prepared. And they were all writing students. I had to get writing from all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the workload was just unbearable. And I was just so overworked that I felt that I wasn't doing a good job, and I was pretty stressed. And after 3 years of that, I went to graduate school and got a master's degree in composition. And to pay for that, I was a teaching assistant. I taught in the writing lab, and I taught freshman composition, and I thought, I really like adult learners. I liked the people in my composition classroom. At Western Illinois at that time, there were a lot of international students from Korea who came to the writing lab, and I really liked working with them on some of their language challenges and the writing they had to do for their classes. And I decided that I wanted to teach adult learners, so I applied for a bunch of community college jobs and didn't get any.
Mm.
And had to go back to high school teaching for a few more years. I didn't get any because I just didn't have enough experience. So I taught high school in West Des Moines for a couple years and just gathered more evidence that I was not cut out for high school teaching. And I also started writing a lot then and getting stuff published in some regional places like the Des Moines Register and the Burlington Hawkeye and, Iowa Woman and a few other magazines, and I really loved that. So I applied to PhD programs, and the one that gave me the very best deal was the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. They were offering me a six-year teaching assistantship, which would cover tuition and give me a stipend, and that was better than anybody else. So that is why I chose Nebraska. And I went to Nebraska thinking that I would take poetry classes, and Nebraska was unique at that time as one of the few schools where you could do what is called a creative dissertation. You could do creative writing instead of academic writing for your dissertation. So I thought that I would write a collection of poetry while I was there. But I ended up discovering the essay. And so for my dissertation, I wrote a collection of nature essays about the two places I call home, which is southeastern Iowa and southeastern Nebraska. And got a lot of those published. That book, my dissertation, won third place in a writing contest. But they only had money that year to publish the first and second place winners. I cried 2 days about that, and then I sent the book to the University of Iowa Press, and they published it.
Ah, congratulations. So that, it sounds like your path to publishing was pretty straightforward.
When I was wanting to write, the term creative nonfiction hadn't been invented yet, and it certainly wasn't being taught in most universities and colleges. So I first tried fiction, and then I tried poetry. I also tried the more academic writing with my master's degree in composition, and I just wasn't finding where I belonged. And then it was actually reading there's a series, the Best American Essay series. Somebody gave me a copy of the 1988 anthology, which was edited by Annie Dillard, and I read the essays in that anthology, just gobbled them up, and knew that that's what I wanted to read and write, and that's what I wanted to teach other people to write, you know, creative nonfiction, personal, imaginative, creative essays. And so it took me a while to find the type of writing I wanted to do, but once I did, it was pretty straight, and I was pretty fortunate. I was doing creative nonfiction at a time that was pretty new in academia, so it was easy to get published, and it was easy to get a job. It's much harder now because this is an area that has really grown. In many ways, it was kind of charmed for me. But I also think that, you know, when things are aligned, when you're living your bliss, you're following your heart's desire, and doing the hard work that goes along with that, that the things do kind of fall into place.
If you stick with it, yeah.
You have to stick with it. You have to work hard.
Yes.
There has to be discipline. But it's also, I think, you know, having some intuition and what is right for me? Where do I belong? Where can I be of service, and how can I fulfill myself?
Now, you said your first book was published by the University of Iowa Press, and Bread, A Memoir of Hunger, is published by the University of Missouri Press.
Uh-huh.
Have you had other publishers, or...?
Yeah, I've had two at Iowa, and then I had two at Nebraska and two at Missouri.
Oh, wow. And, so you're spreading it around the Midwest.
Well, yeah, I'm staying in the Midwest. And, I liked Iowa, but they were, I sent my third book to them, but they weren't, my third book was about so much about Nebraska that I just felt I had to publish it in Nebraska. But my fourth one was a collection of essays about the Midwest, and the editor said, we're just really not publishing collections of essays anymore.
Mm.
So I would have preferred Iowa. I just don't think it's as profitable to be publishing collections of essays. So I went back to Nebraska. They published that. And then my last book is about the Mississippi, Missouri, and Platte Rivers. And I just felt that Missouri was the place to go with that.
Mm.
And I was right. They did well by that book. And then I sent Brad there. I wasn't certain where to send that book. It was so unlike the other books that I wrote. But
I mean, in some, even though it's a, more of a memoir, I'm sure all of your essays have some sort of element of memoir in them.
They do, yeah. The nature essays more in some essays and less in others. But it's my response to a place or you know, something I've seen in the natural world or something I've been thinking about. But this one is pretty intensely autobiographical, much more so than the others. Yeah.
Yes, and so how has that been for you? Because you have to reveal so much of yourself, and does it make you feel vulnerable?
Oh, yes. I had all kinds of concerns about publishing it, and I still have concerns about revealing so much about myself. And, you know, I've done a lot of second-guessing. Was this the right thing to do? And even so, even that I reveal a lot, I felt that I also held back some things from the reader, so there might be some gaps in the story. Somebody might say, I really want to know more about your childhood home.
Mm.
And I just didn't want to go there. My parents are gone. I just didn't want to write a lot about family dynamics. And but yeah, the level of revelation is kind of troubling. And also, this is an illness memoir, and an illness or an illness narrative, and that's a version of one's life that you present yourself as not fully functioning. You're not well. And so I had qualms about that, too. Do I really want to tell people that?
Yeah, because it's not exactly putting your best foot forward.
Right, exactly, exactly. So I don't know. I think, you know, I'll go back to where we started. I felt that I had a call to ministry, to serve people in maybe an unconventional way. And I think the details of my story, you know, are going to turn some people off and some people are going to connect very
well. I think it's very worth reading.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lisa, we're out of time, unfortunately.
It's gone fast. It's been a pleasure to talk with both of you.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. That was Lisa Knopp, author of Bread, A Memoir of Hunger. Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. Remember that anything worth doing is going to take longer than you think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I knew you'd like that.
And find out what you're hungry for and bring that into your life. Nourish yourself.
And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. See you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUU-FM.com and writersvoices.com.